Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this early January 2007 day, January 2nd. Happy New Year to you in case we didn't speak yesterday. First hour of our program today, the draft is a distinct possibility. The Army, our guest says, is in a major personnel mess that will not end with Iraq. And it's entirely possible that a confluence of forces, war, terrorism, environmental catastrophe, could produce a situation where millions of people are needed. And there is, in American politics, a process by which the unthinkable becomes the inevitable. It could happen very quickly. We're speaking with the author of The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military and Why Selective Service is Wrong for America. Professor Philip Gold is with us. In the spring of 2002, he became one of America's first conservatives to oppose the upcoming Iraq War. That led to his departure from Discovery Institute, a prominent conservative think tank. He is the author of many books and hundreds of articles, and is currently working on his next military book, Closing Ranks, America Reconnects with Its Military. He's also finishing his first novel, which is a Washington, D.C. Marine Corps political thriller, A Change of Command. He spent 11 years as a Marine, active, and reserve, retiring as a major with a primary specialty in intelligence, and he also taught history at Georgetown for a number of years. This particular topic, I think, is going to prompt just all kinds of calls, because he not only looks at a military draft, he looks at the role of service in terms of American service in many ways. And so we're going to have an in-depth conversation about all of that. So if you want to join us, you can join us by calling 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Philip Gold, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. The other thing that was happening, you write, in the aftermath of Mission Accomplished in 2004, we were talking a lot more about a resumption of a draft, and as is the case with many of us, you found yourself looking at this for personal reasons because you had a son in high school, right?
I did, and he's now a college student, and he is in the Marine PLC program. He will be a Marine second lieutenant when he graduates.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean, the POC program?
It's a kind of ROTC program, but it doesn't have a term time on campus commitment. It's one or two summers, and then you're commissioned when you graduate. This is assuming, of course, that he passes the program.
Yeah. And you were a Marine for a number of years, for 11 years.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
And you joined this willingly. When was this?
I joined in 1970. I was the only man in my graduating class at Yale University to join the Marines active duty. And it was a very difficult decision, not only because I saw no point in the Vietnam War, but because I was legitimately 4F. I had a lifetime history of asthma and hay fever and all the rest of that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally decided that, as an ethical statement, I had to say that the politics we had developed during that war would ultimately do the country more harm than the war itself. And I think, I'm afraid I was right.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the big reasons why we haven't been able to come to grips with Iraq, and why we should have had a very strong anti-war movement right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say at one point, and this is so true, I'm wondering why we don't do this. It should be very hard to go to war, you write. The Pentagon exists to protect the people. The people don't exist to serve the Pentagon.
This is exactly the point, because we have to get back to what the Founding Fathers understood as the connection between citizenship and military service. And they were very clear that there was an unalienable obligation to participate in the common defense. There is an unalienable right to participate in the common defense. It's one of three civic rights that we enjoy. The other two are voting and jury duty, things we can't do by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the Founders were absolutely adamant this should never translate into a blank check so the federal government can draw upon the people anytime they want to, anytime some president gets the urge to go to war. We have to get back to this notion that defending the country is something a citizen does over the course of a lifetime, but it is not a blank check for the federales.
Mm-hmm. And has that happened a lot recently, this being a blank check, would you say?
Well, you do have this blank check because when we had the draft, which I think is arguably unconstitutional, although during World War II you can make a case that it was an extra constitutional necessity, we kind of by default accepted this notion that draftees could be sent anywhere to do anything. Mm-hmm. No other democracy in the modern world has ever made that assumption. You can use a draftee for anything. And if we go back to an unrestricted federal draft, we're right back in the same shape we were in Vietnam. And we have made the same mistake with our National Guard and our service reserves, that we can send them anywhere to do anything. They're the functional equivalent of what draftees were during Vietnam now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what's happening at the moment, where it seems to me as though, and I was interested in this AP poll where 35% of Americans believe the draft would be reinstituted in the year 2007 in order to, if we have this surge in troops in Iraq, and you write about the major personnel mess that's not going to end with Iraq, we got a shortage of people here. We can't serve somewhere else because we're all tied up in Iraq. So how are we going to deal with that this year? Do you think that there will be significant debate about reinstituting a draft this year?
Well, I think there will be significant debate. Nobody's going to want to do it. Now, Congressman for Life Charlie Rangel will introduce, I think probably this week, his bill for universal national service with military and non-military options. What I see coming down the road is a military disaster on the ground. Now, we Americans have this great belief. It's okay to lose wars, but we never lose a battle. If we go through with this surge or double down or whatever they're calling it, we are sending an additional 30,000 troops into Baghdad, a city of several million people, basically to fight block by block, building by building, house by house. Mm. Horrible type of fighting, mm-hmm. even though we've gotten very good at it, as we've seen in Fallujah and a couple other places. While this is going on, while we're all tied down, my big worry is the Iranians, because the Iranians would absolutely love to administer a defeat to us on the ground somehow, and it can come about in many, many ways. And you have to ask yourself, if all of a sudden you have, you know, an American military defeat, you lose a battalion or brigade, and you've got a few hundred or a few thousand American prisoners being marched through the streets of Tehran with, you know, CNN and Al Jazeera covering the parade, what are the American people going to say? And there is a dormant coalition in Congress of people on the right, conservatives, and some Democrats, of course, who want a very strong army, coupled with the National Service liberals on the left, and you could find almost overnight this coalition forms.
Mm-hmm. As you have said, if we had another major national disaster, too, something like Katrina, you might need a million people or other kinds of, you know, an attack at home or whatever. You might need the service of all kinds of Americans, and we just don't have them.
We don't have them. We saw this during Katrina, where Louisiana National Guard was in Iraq. We just had a very nasty windstorm out here in Seattle, where I live, and it took about 10 days to get power back to everybody.
Really?
Mm. And I live out in the woods, and I kept thinking, you know, what if we had organized everybody out here who owns a chainsaw and have a little chainsaw brigade so that the minute it's over, everybody gets out there and starts moving the fallen trees off the road so the repairs crews can get in. And this, to me, is also the common defense. And mm-hmm. if we are going to get through this mess, and it is a long war, and it is a terrible mess, we have to start getting very creative about what we mean by the common defense. It's not just federal service anymore. It's all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm. You say that you aim to restore the connection between citizenship and military service in a new way that's right for 2007 and beyond.
Yes, ma'am. And the key here is, you know, we use the word service. We don't bother to think too much about what it means. Servants serve. Citizens participate. And I can't overemphasize this. Servants serve. Citizens participate. It is mm-hmm. part of what you do. Now, to give you a couple examples of how we could strengthen our defenses without giving the government this blank check, why can't you have special army units, Army Guard units, Army Reserve units, composed of people who cannot be sent outside the country except upon declaration of war or a declaration of a humanitarian emergency so great that you need it? Many other countries do this. France does it. Germany does it. Only certain units can leave the country. 22, I believe, states have independent state defense forces. These were established during the World Wars when their National Guard units were overseas. Every single state in the Union should have one of these things. You can serve in them as circumstances and abilities permit, you know, over a lifetime. It's a great place to bring in veterans. And the beauty of these independent state militias, which are, by the way, federally recognized under state control and can't be federalized, is that you can build them to suit. The National Guard has to be built as an army. It has to have all the tanks and guns and all the rest of this stuff. An independent state defense force can be whatever that state needs. You can tailor it. You don't have to have the same, you know, physical and age requirements. People can participate. And these state forces, in many ways, I think, are the heir of the colonial militias in a way that the National Guard is not. Mm-hmm. The National Guard is legally recognized as the heir of the old militias. Mm-hmm. But these things have a great place to play.
And if you wanted to sign up for some kind of service, you would have your choice? In other words, if you didn't want to be sent out of country, you wouldn't have to be?
Sure. I mean, basically, if a young person wants to volunteer for unrestricted service, that's fine. The Navy, the Air Force, the Marines should be unrestricted. Many Army units should be unrestricted. But if a young person says, okay, I will do 2 years in the Army, but, you know, I don't want to be sent anywhere to do anything every time some presidential skull twitches, serve in a unit where you are trained. You know what to do. If there's an emergency, you are part of a very significant strategic reserve. I wonder how many young men and women would be interested in something like this. Then, of course, you would have National Guard units that cannot be sent outside the country unless there's a declaration of war. Right now, the law is you cannot be sent involuntarily outside the country more than 2 years out of five, but the Pentagon wants that, you know, loosened.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you have all kinds of specialized, you know, first responder units? My chainsaw brigade that I was talking about,
yeah.
Modeled on Civil Air Patrol, the Coast Guard Auxiliary, things doctors do, things people do with four-wheel drive vehicles in the event of an emergency to get people to hospitals. Because of climate change, because of terrorism, because of many number of other things, this too is now the common defense. And to the extent that these units take pressure off the professionals, off the full-time regulars, that lessens the need for a draft.
Mm-hmm. And how would this be set up? Would it all be voluntary? You're going to get enough people?
I think it would be voluntary at first. It could be made mandatory in the event of an absolute emergency, but would really have to be at the end of our tether for that. Now, would everybody serve? No, of course not. But would you get enough people doing enough stuff enough at the time? I think it's worth finding out.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Philip Gold. He is the author of The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military and Why Selective Service is Wrong for America. He says that politics and economics should be placed in the service of human rights and human warfare, and war should be regulated accordingly. We're looking at broadening service and the use of, you know, this great desire to do good in the world and to do good in the country that I think many of us have, in a way to mobilize that desire to do good to help the world, but also to help the country. So at a time when many of us think that the draft will be reinstituted, and he says you could have this confluence of forces of conservative and liberals, and we could get a draft lickety-split, that it's something that is not a good idea, but it is a good idea to look at the issue of how people can serve in many ways throughout their adult lives if they desire it, and should they have the opportunity to do just that. Phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655 is our number. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now for Philip Gold, 800-486-8655 is the number, and Mike from Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. My comment would be that I think probably the draft is a good idea because I see it as being a great equalizer. And on the other hand, if there is a draft and everybody's treated equally, it forces people to become involved in political decisions. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for your call. Philip?
Well, I don't think we should force people to be virtuous. The purpose of a military is not to improve people. It's not social engineering in that sense, although other countries have used it that way. And, you know, this business of, you know, you meet a lot of people, you're equal, and so on, is very true. And, you know, I remember when I got to the Marines out of Yale University as, you know, Ivy League hippie intellectual, I met a lot of people who really changed my life. But when I discuss this, I sometimes say, you know, well, yeah, I guess about 500 Marines had their lives really improved by meeting me, and everybody goes, huh? You know. So this is kind of a benefit, but it's not a reason to do it.
But what about his point, though, that if we had military conscription, that it would make us less likely to go to wars that may not be popular, that we would need more of a popular sentiment that we are going to engage in Iraq, we are going to engage in Vietnam?
Well, to me, this argument is like, you know, putting an alcoholic in a liquor store and telling him to sober up. The constitutional checks, you know, have been lost. the fact that a declaration of war has meaning. It's not just a piece of paper. If Congress were to do its job, we wouldn't even have to worry too much about this. Now, that same argument was made about the National Guard after Vietnam when it was called the Total Force Policy. The Army was structured so deliberately so they could not go to major war without major mobilization, which meant major political support. And it worked beautifully in Desert Storm, but we've seen now that first President Clinton in the Balkans, now President Bush, was able piecemeal to dodge that. So this de facto people's veto, it was called, of mobilizing the reserves and the Guard, didn't work. And I don't see how arming millions of young men and women, and I emphasize women because women would be drafted, is going to make us any less likely to go to war.
We go next to Bill from Waukesha. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
I'm calling because I find myself agreeing very strongly with today's guest. And I find that surprising as a very strong leftist and a recent college graduate. I'm on my way right now back now to South Dakota, where I'm currently serving with Teach for America.
Oh.
And I think the numbers with Teach for America in terms of applications each year from the top universities in the nation speak to this desire from people of my generation to be participating in some sort of national service.
Mm-hmm.
So I found this resonance really interesting.
Where are you teaching, Bill?
I teach on the Rosebud Reservation.
Uh-huh.
It's in central southern South Dakota.
Huh. Good for you. That's great. Philip?
Yes, I believe there is a desire to do these things, and it should be voluntary. I reject totally the notion of national service where, you know, some people carry a rifle and some people work in daycare centers. And I was debating this a while back and just finally asked the guy, you know, look, we are leaving our young people $4.7 trillion in debt. Maybe that's service enough. Why compel them to change our bedpans for us? And if I could pick up on something you said before the break, at the risk of giving a commercial for my sweetie, my wife, Erin Solaro, went to Iraq and Afghanistan to study American service women over there. Subject nobody talks about. Her book is out. It's called Women in the Line of Fire. I recommend it. But the point that she made to me when she came back from Afghanistan was, in Iraq, we're trying to, you know, force these people to accept a Western-style democracy that has no place there. In Afghanistan, we're simply trying to get them to improve the standards by which they treat each other. And that really resonated with me, how much we could do just trying to get people to treat each other better.
Yeah. Isn't that true? I mean, some of it seems simplistic, but wouldn't we create this enormous goodwill in the whole world if we did just that?
I agree entirely. And, you know, there's this old Rudy Valley song from the 1920s called, "You're going to do it someday, so why not do it now?" And when you look at things like, you know, global abolition of child labor, rational ecological policies, real emphasis on human rights, real emphasis on women's rights, because women are the ones with the most to gain and the least to lose right now. We're going to do it someday. Why not do it now? And forget about all this forcing people to be free according to our standards.
And I think that you write in the book, Bill, thanks very much for your call, that there is this kind of quiet patriotism. Your son exemplifies that, and from conversations you've had with his friends, they want to do their part, right? I think there is a lot of that among young people.
They want to do their part, but they are not interested in being manipulated. They are not interested in being used. And as my son, who is a very smart man, tells me, you know, freedom isn't free, but if you're going to pay, you want to get your money's worth.
Let's go next to Mohammed from Madison. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen, and to your guests. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Why would the government want to return to a draft when they've already made the decision to outsource what a lot of the military used to do to private companies, and they've also very heavily invested in the prison industrial complex throughout America, which used to be, and the only person in the Congress who's calling for a return to the draft seems to be Congressman Rangel, I believe, who probably remembers during the Vietnam War, a lot of the individuals in the central cities who ended up in Vietnam was an alternative to either a prison sentence. Well, most of the times a prison sentence. Do you want to go to prison or do you want to go to Vietnam? And so I just can't see them returning to that, but I'll end with this. If I can quote Chris Rock, the first people who should be considered Americans should be people who have served in the military. So to remove that as an option, to me, is kind of sad for a vast majority of the people in the country.
Thanks, Mohammed, for your call.
Okay, he's very correct in one strange way. The total force used to be called the active and reserve forces. In 2006, I was reading the Quadrennial Defense Review, where they now define the total force as active, reserve, civilian, and contractor. And this just scared me to death, because for the first time we're saying these contractors have become so important to us that we have to give them formal recognition. Contractors can do a lot of things, but they're very expensive. They're like children. They need an awful lot of adult supervision. The question of, you know, are you a citizen because you serve is a very old one also. It goes back to the Greeks, you know, that you're not a full citizen until you have served or gone to war or what have you. I would stay with the, you know, if you're born here, you're a citizen. And military service is something you do as a part of citizenship. The Vietnam draft, which I was in, of course, was so totally corrupt that we can never again go back to it. Any future draft would be conducted by lottery. But when I was researching the book, I was astonished to discover that over 43% of all men who turned 18 during the draft era wore a uniform in one capacity or another. Over 4 out of 10 actually did serve. During World War II, 49%. Hmm. The two pools were very different. But even at the height of the Good War, over half the people were getting out.
Why?
Yeah, and the more I looked at the draft, I felt like a dentist. A guy sits in the chair and he says he's got a little toothache, and then you start looking, and all you see is more and more rot. The deeper you go, the worse it gets. The draft has always been so systemically corrupt, institutionally corrupt, on purpose. It was designed that way to keep people out so you can defuse political tension.
Hmm.
That it was not only unconstitutional, but it was also morally absolutely heinous.
Hmm. I'm very surprised by the number of men who did not serve in World War II. Why is that, Philip?
Well, one of the big reasons, of course, is that the pool back then included 18 to 44. But, and, you know, at the high end, if you were 18 years old and you had no skills or what have you, chances are you would be drafted.
Mm-hmm.
But there were any number of dodges built into the system. For example, if you were married, you know, right at the beginning of 40, you were exempt. Children kept you exempt until 42, I believe.
Mm.
And you saw in 42, 43, a mini baby boom in this country that nobody ever talks about. The birth rate spiked, all these guys trying to stay out, which had happened in World War I. Medical standards. The Army has said, if you're not fit for combat, we don't want you. Enormously wasteful of manpower. But one of the reasons was, and this goes back to World War I, they did not want a lot of veterans hanging around soaking up money in the hospitals afterwards. So they wanted you fit to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
There were no blanket occupational deferments except for clergy and then divinity students. If you were in the so-called critical war industry, your boss had to certify it, and your local board had to pass on it. And that was the key to everything, was the local board. Nobody really was watching what they were doing. As long as they met their quota, everybody was happy. Yet those quotas were determined by the number of people the board itself said were 1A. Enormous opportunities for favoritism, for protecting people, for the reverse, especially since the boards were all white, all male, and usually local notables back then. And one form of favoritism that has never really been discussed, and I don't know how you prove this now, how many draft boards as that war went on said, you know, we have enough Gold Star mothers, we're protecting our young men from now on. The bottom line was everything from the local board system to this, you know, plethora of deferments and ways to play the system was designed to keep people out. And then when you went into the 50s where you had this huge excess of bodies over needs, General Hershey, the Selective Service Director, very proudly and openly said, we are now engaged in social engineering. They called it channeling. You know, we will get men to do things they otherwise wouldn't do, like go to college, get a PhD, get married, you know, you name it. Socially beneficial activities by using the draft, the threat of the draft to force them. And the tragedy of Vietnam, of course, one of the tragedies was we went into that war with that type of channeling system.
Mm-hmm. We're welcoming phone calls for Philip Gold. He's the author of The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military, and Why Selective Service is Wrong for America. We have a couple lines open. If you've been trying to reach us, you could at this very moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. Doug from Eau Claire, our next caller. Hi, Doug.
Good morning. I have a question after I have this brief, two questions. One is, I would say it's fair to say that there's at least 50, if not 60% of the population in the United States right now, excuse me, who are very distrustful of both the government and the military. And I think in part because we have such lousy policymakers who are making decisions, foreign decisions, that have very strong ties with corporations that profit from war. And as we move into this next era of scarce resources, my question to the guest is, obviously, we're going to be, as he stated earlier, having some problems with our borders and both the flooding of people coming in because of devastation, because of global warming, and also our role in going into third world countries and exploiting the labor and the resources for our own ends. And I think we need to have a national discussion about the kinds of corporations that we want to support so that we can have a better harmonious relationship that is a give and take between ourselves and other countries. And that's my question.
Well, I would say that it is time for the United States, in regard to our relations with the world, to ask ourselves one overwhelming question. If we're so cute, how come we can't get a date? And we need to spend some time in the mirror before we try to save anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one subject that nobody wants to talk about, but I think is enormously important, is the role of women in all this. We have now had over 155,000 women go to war since 9/11 as volunteer professionals. This has never happened before in the history of the world. And what we have discovered is that all the disasters that everybody thought would happen not only haven't happened, but the women are performing, you know, extremely well across the board. It's a new generation that's making up the rules as they go along. It's time for the institution to catch up in a lot of ways. Any future draft would have to include women because the Congress, which has the constitutional power to make rules for the military, has always deferred to the military's assessment of its own needs, and then the Supreme Court has deferred to the Congress, which is why women were not required to register for the draft. The Army can't make that case anymore. Women will be drafted if there is a draft. Additionally, in today's New York Times, General Shelley Kashvili, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, came out in favor of dropping the gay ban. So we are now moving, you know, in a very strange, ironic way, toward a world in which all our citizens are equal in terms of military obligation. And I want to see our citizens serving. It's just I do not want them giving a blank check to the government.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, because I've been struck, there's been an awful lot of coverage. Thanks very much for the call, Doug. There's been a lot of coverage over the weekend over the 3,000th death in Iraq. And you know, there's been a lot of reports on television of, you know, the first death and families coping with that. And I'm wondering how all of this plays into a consideration of national service or a consideration of what's going to happen in Iraq. But there's this growing sense, I think, Philip, that it's that question of you're dying for something which may have been a very large mistake. And I'm wondering how the national psyche, how we're taking that in. What do we do with that? It's very troubling.
You know, I sometimes think that in this long war that we're in, and Bush got it right, it is a long war, Iraq will be kind of the Gallipoli campaign of this war, a total disaster that, had it worked, would have been wonderful, but there was never any chance it could work. And yes, you know, it may come down to the fact that these people did die in vain. But, you know, you still have, you know, the rest of the problem out there. Now, Tom Friedman did a brilliant article in the New York Times on thinking about this stuff. And he said very simply at one point, you can't want it more than they do. You can't want for them things more than they want for themselves.
Mm.
And if we learn just one thing from that, you cannot force people to be like us. Deep down, everybody is not a frustrated American trying to get out. Maybe that will have some redemptive value. I don't know.
Yeah. Scott from Madison, hi.
Hi there. I very much believe in national service or participation, as your guest calls it. I don't think it should be mandatory, but what I would do, I'm not talking about just military. I'm talking about, you know, Peace Corps, VISTA, all the things that people could do to work on the infrastructure and help the country. But what I would like to do is, I don't believe it should be mandatory. I would like to make it, however, hugely coercive, meaning that if you want the rights of being a citizen, and I would include in that voting, getting any kind of federal loans, receiving Social Security, not paying in, but receiving Social Security, that at some point you would have had to have completed your service obligation.
Well, that's interesting. Philip, what do you think?
I'm troubled by non-military service because, you know, as Ayn Rand put it so well once, so whenever you hear somebody preaching sacrifice, chances are there's somebody else around collecting sacrifices. Who benefits from this? What you would be doing is creating an enormous governmental bureaucracy. A lot of this work would have to be public-private partnerships. Whose daycare center gets the cheap labor? Whose hospital? Whose school? And it's not cheap labor because, you know, you have to pay these people once. If there's a college benefit attached to it, you pay them twice. I don't think we need any more cheap labor. We need real jobs for real Americans who are making a decent wage. And to the extent that you have a compulsory program, which is what the gentleman is not talking about, you're simply creating another peon class. And we do not exist to serve each other as citizens. We exist to participate together. So the gentleman is quite right. Let's everybody go out and do stuff. But let's be very careful about making it coercive. Now, Paul Glastras, who's editor of the Washington Monthly, pushes an idea that service of some kind should be a prerequisite for attending a four-year college. You cannot attend a four-year college without doing at least 1 year of something. And I asked him how he proposed to enforce this, and he said, well, with only one exception, Hillsdale College, every college in the country takes federal money, and you just have the federal government make that a condition of taking money. And all I could think of was, oh, great, you take a dime so they own you. This is not our way of doing things.
Wait, what about high school students? Would you have mandatory service programs so that we would get in the frame of mind of going into service when we got out of high school?
There is a difference between giving the kids a taste of service, which I think is a very good idea, as part of the educational process. And my son did this in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You do a few hours, you learn a little bit, you have more information on which to make your decisions. And, you know, every so often where we were, you know, the leaves got raked or, you know, that type of thing, that's fine.
Right.
But when you're talking about ripping people out of their lives for a year or 2 years on a mandatory basis, absolutely not. But, you know, as the gentleman said, this should be voluntary, and more than voluntary, it should just be a normal part of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Dick is next from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A lot of good points. In Dubuque here and along the river, we've got those construction projects, the parks and the dams and stuff that were done during the Depression. And I often thought that somehow, and I don't know how, you know, with the economy the way it is, that the possibility of that type of a service, maybe like New Orleans and fixing dikes and things like they did during the dam, built the lock and dam systems during the Depression. But part of it is learning how to work. We got such a diverse group. We put in some national purpose to people.
Yes.
And that type of thing. I don't know any comments on the Depression era type of programs.
It's an interesting point. Philip?
Well, yesterday I was rereading FDR's second inaugural address in 37, and everybody ought to pull it off the net and read it because it shows you how far we have fallen.
What prompted you to read that yesterday?
I wanted to track down the quote of, I see one-third of a nation ill-fed, ill-clad, ill-housed.
I see.
Because I'm doing a column right now. It starts out, I see one-third of a nation overfed, over-medicated, and over-entertained. I don't know if we can get back to that. But if it's going to start, it cannot be top-down. It has to be people doing things. You know the old cliche, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. You know, it may come to that because the gentleman is right. This country's falling apart. Infrastructure is shot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we may end up 10 years from now all filling sandbags on the East Coast. Who knows?
Well, that's a depressing thought for early in 2007, isn't it? But there are a lot of huge issues that confront us right now. They're sobering.
It's scary. And, out here in the Pacific Northwest, because we get earthquakes and volcanoes and we're overdue for tsunami and that, you know, we're basically pretty well prepared. Our de facto slogan is, in an emergency, the best thing you can do for the system is not need it. But we're beginning to realize that system may not be there whether we need it or not.
We welcome phone calls. Thanks very much for your call, Dick, from Dubuque. And those of you who are on hold, just stay right with us. We have a couple lines open now. Philip Gold is our guest. He's the author of The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military, and Why Selective Service is wrong for America. The subject under consideration is the draft, but he says more broadly military service, but the broadest of all is this question, and it's a good question. Is there, can there be any morally compelling, rationally structured, and militarily effective relationship between service and citizenship in the world and the age that is now upon us? I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And in the spirit of starting off a new year right, we are going to speak the second hour of our program with the author of 365 Ways to Change the World, How to Make a Difference One Day at a Time. We go back to phone calls now for Philip. His book is The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military, Why Selective Service is Wrong for America. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we go to Buck from Madison. Hi, Buck.
Hello. Mr. Gold, I heard you when you were on Wisconsin Public Radio before, and I got your book and read it and thought it was superb and Xeroxed, the scenario at the end. Where if you reject everything, you've got to pay another 10% on your income tax.
Well, you know, college tuition ain't getting any cheaper either.
I have the reason I'm against the draft. I was born in '46, and so remember Vietnam very well. I want to misappropriate a Republican's term. I want to starve the beast, so that people like Shrub the Illegitimate don't have enough soldiers to indulge their fantasies. Can you address this?
We need an army. It's a nasty world out there. The issue is really, what do we use it for? And we have to, you know, not only grab our Congress and get them to realize that the declaration of war is not just a nicety, it is a statement of national purpose, and stop waffling it. Now, what we're going to see in 2007, I think this is already clear, is the Democrats will complain and complain and complain, and then let George Bush do whatever he wants. Our hope is that by 2008, we get so sick of the posturing and the posturing that's leading to all this destruction and death, that we start expecting something out of our elected representatives beyond them getting ready for the next election. Now, frankly, I keep hoping for a third party that would be created really top-down by the disgruntled good people in both parties who would bring their expertise, and their money, and their contacts with them. But we've got a long way to go before that type of situation can prevail.
Mm-hmm. So of all the people who are out there, and this may be too early to ask you this question, is there anybody who strikes you as the kind of person who can deal with that issue of service and citizenship in the world, somebody who's thinking in that direction?
In the Republican Party, the only person at the moment I would consider for president would be Chuck Hagel. He's a solid man who has been there. He knows what he's talking about. He's thoughtful. He understands things. On the Democratic side, there's something to be said for Mark Warner, former governor of Virginia, although he's never had any foreign policy experience that I know of. And I keep looking at Barack Obama, and every time I hear him, I keep thinking, this guy and Rachel Ray must have been twins separated at birth. It's all comfort food. The last thing this country needs right now is comfort food.
Comfort food? What do you mean?
Comfort food is tell them what they want to hear the way they want to hear it. And there's a genre in publishing, I never heard this term before until a little while ago, called comfort food books, which is basically, you know what you're going to get, you get it straight, and when it's over, you got it. Whether that is Ann Coulter or Bill O'Reilly or, Christian, fundamentalist Christian writing, what have you. The absolute last thing we need at this juncture is comfort food. We all need to be as challenged as we possibly can be.
Mm-hmm.
And we all need to realize that sometimes freedom begins when you say no to the people who tell you what your choices are.
Hmm. Anything else, Buck?
No.
No.
Thank you very much
Thanks.
For being on our air.
Thanks very much for your call. Happy New Year, Buck. Our number is 800-486-8655. We go next to Tom from Waukon, is it, Iowa?
Yes.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern, if we don't go back to something like the draft, is the increasing political right moving of the people in uniform. People self-select. There's some things they're not going to continue to support and be part of. And what I fear is that we would end up with, and Mr. Bush has already said, people ought to know by now what they're getting into. It's been 6 years of his administration. And my concern has to do with the effect of a heavily weighted right-wing military. You've already seen it, the Air Force Academy, evangelicals taking over, and you have to be an evangelical Christian kind of thing. So that's my concern. And I fear for the democracy. And the neocons are not going to want to leave easily. And I fear for potential military militia activity against the democracy if it gets so heavily to the right.
Philip.
It's an interesting question because during the Clinton years, there was this great literature on the military is becoming far more conservative than the American people. When you're talking about the military, you're talking about the officer corps, in this case, basically. And it is probably even today more conservative, but there, believe me, because of Iraq, there is no longer this Republican hegemony among the officer corps. There are two other factors. One is, as you mentioned, the rise of the evangelicals. And this is a very serious problem because there are an awful lot of good chaplains who ain't there. When I was a Marine, our best chaplains were Catholics because, you know, they were unmarried, they could go drinking with us, this kind of thing. And you had a lot of mainstream Protestants. There's an enormous shortage of Catholic priests, of course, and the mainstream Protestant denominations are not particularly interested in sending people to the military. So you do find an increasing evangelical dominance, which I think is very unhealthy, and we have had scandals. Yale Divinity School had to send a team to the Air Force Academy to see what on earth was going on there. But the greatest factor right now is probably going to be multi-generation, because you now have husband-wife military couples becoming increasingly common and their kids going into the service. And that creates a very different kind of mindset, regardless of their politics or belief, of almost hereditary military caste. And these could be very good people. But I'm not sure that you want an officer corps that is dominated by second and third generations officers.
But my concern is a right-wing administration and a right-wing military could lead to no democracy.
It certainly could, but to say that the two are right-wing does not mean that they're going to see eye-to-eye on everything. The Army hates the neocons. The last thing they wanted to do was the Iraq War. They certainly didn't want to do a four-year occupation. The Army does not want the draft because, among other things, it would make it possible to do more Iraqs. So even though they might be, simpatico philosophically, when the bureaucratic agendas of the military kick in, they can usually defeat any president who, wants them to do what they don't want to do. Very difficult situation going back to Rumsfeld, where you put in a civilian secretary of defense. Somebody's going to dominate somebody. It's either going to be the civilian dominating the joint chiefs and services or vice versa. Tragedy was that he wasn't able to use his dominance properly. The thing with the military is, in the end, it's a bureaucracy, and bureaucracies, their first duty is to take care of themselves. And most bureaucrats can outlast most presidents in those matters. Does this mean that in the event of some extreme emergency, we wouldn't end up with martial law or something like that? I don't know. I just hope not.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Reed next from Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Good morning. Say, I'd just like to say first that I am a veteran, and I was a volunteer. I was an RA. That aside, the current occupant of the White House really did our country a great disservice after 9/11 when he squandered the opportunity he had for bringing the country together. I think we would never have a need for a draft if he had actually brought the country together. We were willing to work, to give of our time, our energy, and also the great deal of money that has been squandered on this unnecessary war could have been better used right here at home or around the world in a much more humanitarian cause.
Mm-hmm. Philip?
I think he's exactly right. When George Bush told us to go shopping, and we did, that was not just a way of getting us back to normalcy. That was a way of saying, we're the pros, we're the experts, mm-hmm. we're the elite, we'll take care of it. Mm. And it didn't work that way.
Yeah. And when you think about all the discussions we had of why did this happen to us, and how to win the hearts and minds of people around the world, and whatever happened with that. We're not winning the hearts and minds of anybody, I don't think.
Well, you know, for the rest of the world, this war was always about us and about how we were going to dominate
right.
the world.
Right.
And the biggest problem now is that we don't have to win anybody's hearts and minds. They have to win each other's. The Iraq War will not be determined by who loves us. It will be determined by whether or not the Sunni and the Shia can get along. And over again in the rest of the world. We have to understand, you know, that the rest of the world does not spend all its time thinking about us. You know, we're like teenagers. Someday you're going to have to realize the world doesn't spend nearly as much time thinking about you as we think they do or they should.
So is there any way right now for us to help the Sunnis and Shias respect each other?
I don't see it, because if we go into Baghdad and we take out the Sunni militias, assuming we can, you're talking about sending Americans into a city of several million people. How many civilians are we going to kill? The assumption of the plan is that the Shia would become more peaceful because they no longer had, you know, the Sunni to worry about. In fact, probably the Shia would simply use the opportunity to reinforce their dominance and become even more difficult. They don't play by our rules. And until we realize that, you know, they're not going to, all we are going to do is keep wasting ourselves there. And, you know, there was a book that came out in the 80s called Backfire by a historian named Lauren Barrett. I think he may have taught it at Wisconsin. And a study of how we got into Vietnam. And you can go through that book, cross out Vietnam, right in Iraq, and it's the same book. And there's one phrase in there that has absolutely haunted me since I read it, about how we got into Vietnam. And it's something like, our mythology told us we were good, our technology made us strong, our bureaucracies provided the procedures. It was not a winning combination. We did it again.
Thanks, Reed, for the call. Let's go next to Brinley from Bristol. Hi, Brinley.
Oh, yes. I think I have a solution to the problems you've been mentioning.
Great.
It has most of the advantages and very few of the disadvantages, and that is something that has been done quite often in the past by all of the major and mostly successful imperial powers in history, and that is, if you need more troops, hire them. Mercenaries, foreign mercenaries. Or if you don't like the term foreign mercenaries, you can use guest workers in uniform. I mean, half the Imperial Roman army were, in effect, mercenaries. Look at the British, the French, the Italians, the Germans, all during the 17th, 18th, 19th century, into the 20th century, they used mercenaries. We even used mercenaries in Vietnam. They're the Nungs. And they've all, some of them have been bad, some of them have been good, some of them have been very good. The British today are still using Gurkha mercenaries. The French Foreign Legion, some of the best fighting troops in the world. Why don't we use them? I mean,
all right, Philip.
Well, there's a downside to that, because the classic imperial strategy has been, since no empire has ever been able to generate enough of its own forces, the gentleman is quite right, is you tie yourself to the local elites and the local forces so that they have, you know, their interest is with you and not with their own people. In Latin America, it's sometimes called dependency capitalism. The elites have more to gain by working with us than with their own people. Problem is, ultimately it catches up with you. Your own people either kill you or you just can't keep it up that much longer. There has been talk, believe it or not, about opening up armed forces recruiting stations in foreign countries. Now, you know, the armed service has always been a way to advance an immigrant citizenship. That's fine. I think that's great. But when you start hearing people talking about, you know, we need recruiting stations in Nairobi or Mexico City or what have you, you really got to wonder. Now, I've been working on a theory to how we can finance our Defense Department. As long as we're dealing with novelties, I think we should have what you might call a Britney Spears tax, or perhaps a Brangelina tax, a special war tax on every trashy periodical available at supermarket checkouts. And, you know, you can read your junk, and you'll be paying for our wars at the same time.
Yeah. Not a bad idea. Thanks for the call. Allison is next from Racine. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a couple comments. First comment was that my husband, who is Italian, actually was living there when they still had required military service. And at that time, actually, they had a choice between military or civil service. And he chose to do civil service and actually worked for a nursing home, helping out, driving the patients around, things like that. And I thought that was kind of an interesting alternative to having to serve in the military. He still served his country and did something to help out his local community at the same time.
We have about 20 seconds left. Philip?
This was the West German experience. They passed out exemptions like candy mints and then used the cheap labor to run their welfare state. I believe they're still doing it. Again, I believe that you should compel people only in one area where the physical survival of the nation is at stake. All these things are wonderful to do, but they should never be compelled.
Hmm. And thanks very much for your call. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody, and for this really interesting conversation. Philip, we thank you for being with us. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Professor Philip Gold, the book is The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military and Why Selective Service is Wrong for America. It has just been published by Ballantine Books. He is the author of a number of books and lots of articles and is currently working on his next military book titled The Closing Ranks, America Reconnects with Its Military, and he's finishing his first novel, which is a Washington, D.C. Marine Corps political thriller titled A Change of Command. He taught at Georgetown for a number of years, spent 11 years as a Marine, and was one of America's first conservatives to oppose the upcoming Iraq War, which led to his departure from Discovery Institute, a prominent conservative think tank. We have news coming up. Thanks to Rita Thomas for producing this program and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network.